President Trump has been trying to end the Russia-Ukraine war since even before he came into office and has been trying rather fruitlessly since to bring it to an end. He might want to put a little bit more effort into it now if he gets the time, because many things are spinning around it in the world that are mitigating against having a good outcome. We're going to talk about some of those also. But one of the things he might want to pay a little bit more attention to is that even within the own camp of the West, there is more and more fracturing and more disunity that undercuts any kind of an idea to bring the Russia-Ukraine war to a good end. To try and help us make sense of all of this mess that's floating around here is Colonel Doug McGregor, defense and foreign policy analyst, former advisor to the Secretary of Defense, highly decorated combat veteran, and just incredible guy. Doug, welcome to the show.
After you finish talking about me, I feel like a Christmas tree. Highly decorated. Well, all right, I'm sorry.
Well, when you put it like that, you kind of are. I mean, if we put all your medals and stuff in your actual accomplishments, if we put some lights on it, it would be pretty good. Yeah. We'll think about that next time.
We'll keep the lights off right now.
Fair enough. But let's look at the issues that are going on here. I want to start off looking at a little bit of a different place than many think is the headlines, kind of a middle of the road one. But I think one that's a lot more important than it may have appeared, and that is from the foreign minister of Luxembourg, who was talking today in Brussels, and there's lots of meetings going on, lots of people floating around. One of the cameras caught him, though, actually chiding Volodymyr Zelensky, who is trying anyway to give an ultimatum to the European Union that you will invite us in and we will become members next year. That didn't go over well.
And so it's important to support Ukraine. That's the first thing. But the guarantees are important. I know that I just heard that President Zelensky said that they have to be member next year. I'm sorry. I told him also several times, don't give ultimatums. It's not in your interest. The fact is, there are rules, they have the Copenhagen criteria, and we need to fulfill them. We cannot say that there are criteria for the one and not for the other. What I believe in, and when we spoke about new mechanism, for example, in Europe, we have also this European political community. Why don't we make it more sexy, this European political community, without all the obligations of the 27? And you make an EPC where you have 35, 40 members with economic advantages, with the roaming, with a pseudo Schengen or an alias Schengen possibility, kind of this stuff.
He's saying, listen, and by the way, not only can you not give an ultimatum to the EU, while we're talking about the EU, do we really need the EU? Maybe we can have some more ad hoc groups to do other things with less constraints on them. And I think he's given the voice of a lot of the medium and smaller sized groups inside the European Union. Do you think the Kai Kallases and the Ursula von der Leyen have overplayed their hand and maybe they're not so powerful as they think?
I think that's the understatement of the year. I think the Luxembourg foreign minister is a voice of reason. Unfortunately, it's going to be drowned out by the voices of stupidity and ignorance. You know, Zelensky should have been told by President Trump months and months ago to shut up and color and get the hell out of the Oval Office. He's a fool, and he is allowed to be a fool because there are people still funding him. Because his real mission is to keep this war going as long as possible. That's all. That's why Zelensky is there. It's to continue to keep the war going so that Russians will suffer. Russians will be killed. Unfortunately, it's turned out the other way. Ukrainians are the ones who are dying in great numbers, not the Russians. Although here in the West, people are still confused. They think Russian casualties are enormous. They're not. Ukraine's army is reduced to a shadow of its former existence. And right now, the only thing that keeps the Ukrainians on the battlefield is the reluctance of the Russians to advance further west. Now, that may change in the near future. Right now, given the circumstances of the weather over there, I don't think they're going to go very far. But, you know, nevertheless, I think the Luxembourg foreign minister is right. Unfortunately, again, Zelensky doesn't care. He's operating basically at the behest of London and Washington. And you have foolish people like Macron and Merz who are still saying, sure, go ahead. We'll do everything we can for you, when they should be throwing this man under the bus.
And, you know, and that's ironic, Doug, because at Davos, it was Zelensky who threw them under the bus. I don't know if you caught all of his statements, but there was a couple in particular where he ravaged the United States and just said he's sick and tired of a lot of things that we say and then don't follow through. And then he directly called out the leadership class in Europe and saying, you guys keep promising all this stuff, but it's like Groundhog Day. It's always the same thing over and over and over, and you don't do anything until it comes close to an election. I mean, he says this out loud, and there's no ramifications. There's no repercussions. How can the leaders of Europe be that weak?
Oh, well, that's an entirely different subject. I mean, we got over decades of re-education after World War II and the systematic proliferation of globalists in positions of power. I don't know if you saw it or not, but Soros was interviewed and explained in great detail how he had grown generations of globalists. People like Macron, a very, very good example, Starmer and others, and then position them in power. He takes full and complete credit for the ruling political class, whatever that is, in Ukraine. So I think this is something that's been long in the works. And I'm sure Zelensky is trying to shame people now into helping him. And we're not helping because President Trump ought to be much harsher in his treatment of the man and make it clear that it's over. But he hasn't done that. You know, remember, President Trump, like it or not, is the de facto leader of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. He's not leading it. You know, you could criticize and carp at it, which is something he's done, but it's his job to lead it. He's not leading it anywhere. And so these Europeans are moving in whatever particular direction most suits them.
Now, you mentioned what he's not doing with NATO. Even though he's at the head of it, he's not actually leading it, which are two very distinct, separate things. And in the absence of that, then you have a lot of people pulling their own directions. Now, I just showed you a little bit about on the economic front and the political front, the European Union, you have some of their members trying to start to look a little bit out. Well, in NATO itself, Mark Rutte, a couple of days ago, was talking about the situation in NATO. What happens if the U.S. pulls out? And one might have thought, especially among the Europeans, that he might say, hey, we need to start maybe looking at charting our own way or taking care of things ourselves because we can't count on the United States, because that's what many were saying. Instead, he says this.
When President Trump is doing good stuff, I will praise him. And I don't mind him publishing text messages. And if anyone thinks here, again, that the European Union or Europe as a whole can defend itself without the US, keep on dreaming. You can't. We can't. We need each other. But for Europe, if you really want to go it alone, and those of you who are planning for that, forget that you can ever get there with 5%. It will be 10%. You have to build up your own nuclear capability. That costs billions and billions of euros.
So, Doug, since World War II ended in 1945, NATO started in 1949, the world has radically transformed before then. Why should the Europe continue to say, and why should the leader, the European leader of NATO, continue to tell all of his compatriots, and he lectured them on that in that platform right there, don't go it alone. Don't do your own security. Don't make plans to actually be responsible for our security and not rely on the United States, who's being increasingly unreliable. Even at that, why can they just never move forward in history thinking that it's going to always be 1949?
Well, let's sort facts from fiction. He made some statements that are categorically true. He's absolutely right. Given the state of the European Union and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, these are groups of 35 states that ultimately all want to have it their way. You know, you've heard this commercial that says, have it your way, come to Wendy's or something, have it your way. That's the problem in Europe. Everyone, all these little European states, and they are little. Remember, what have you got? 5 million people in Norway, 8 or 9 million people in Sweden. I don't know what the Danish population is now, but it can't be more than 7 or 8 million. Then Germany sits there with 80 million, and you've got another 11 million Austrians that you could, or 10 million Austrians that you could lump with the Germans because, frankly speaking, they're all German speakers. Then you have the French, the British 50-something, 56 million. I don't know where the French are now, but I don't think it's that high. No one can effectively lead Europe on their own. when has Europe been united? Certainly within the last 300 years. Well, it was united under Napoleon Bonaparte. Napoleon squandered that leadership and opportunity in Russia needlessly. The next time it was completely united was under Adolf Hitler. And he too marched into Russia and squandered that opportunity. In other words, unless you have a figure that commands the total resources of at least one of the nations and can effectively integrate and force into alliance the rest of the countries and then employ them in unison or in a state of unity, there is not going to be any unity in Europe. One of the things that was patently obvious when I was over there in the Supreme Headquarters of Allied Powers Europe is that the Europeans were quite willing to cooperate and be led by us because they absolutely loathed the possibility that it would have to follow another European. In other words, these little petty squabbles and hatreds were sort of enshrined as a rationale for doing what we wanted as opposed to doing what was in their interest. It's a hopeless situation. In that sense, he's right. On the other hand, he's dead wrong. If you could get control of Germany, at least Germany and Austria, and then bring in the French, there's enough military power that could be constituted from those populations, their scientific industrial base, add to it Poland. Poland has always been either really a great military power or potentially a great military power. If you go back and look at those nations, put them together, you've got a ferocious capability that no one is going to take lightly. But no one will coalesce because there is no one to coalesce around. There's no real leadership. Now, I think, you know, this is a vacuum. It will eventually be filled. We will see new people emerge. But right now, until this generation of feckless globalists is removed from office, I don't think you're going to see anything happen.
And well, now let me ask you, maybe to get to that point, you said at the top of this show that the United States is at the head of NATO, but the President Trump himself is not providing leadership. So it's just waffling around and you have all these people just keep tugging at their different interests and whatnot, not following anybody else, not being willing to go out on their own. That you can't maintain that for very long. I mean, inertia and just in friction is going to end up having its say and the thing's going to fall apart. I don't see any chance that shorn of the unifying Soviet Union Warsaw Pact focus that we had all during the Cold War, absent that, I don't see any way you get this herd of cats back together again. So it seems to me inevitable that at some point this thing's either just going to meander to a death or it's, somebody's finally going to start breaking out. I don't know one way or the other, but how much longer do you think it can go on like this?
Well, I think a couple of more years you could see this meandering that you're talking about. But eventually, it's one of these things where it will end with a whimper, not a bang. Suddenly, the buildings in Brussels will be empty. And the European states will move on to organize themselves as they see fit to assure their own security. I think that's going to happen. And some of it is going to be driven by financial and economic reality. I mean, look at Germany. A truly great nation that is now in complete ruins. It's almost on the verge of poverty because of the globalists, because of their determination to destroy the scientific industrial base, which has created enormous problems with employment. It's destroyed the wealth of the country. It's destroying its human capital by replacing it with people that are foreigners, aliens. So the bottom line is that this is coming to an end, regardless of what we do or say at this point. And I think if you look objectively at President Trump, I think he's reached that conclusion. And he's decided, well, you know, we've got other fish to fry. We've got other more important things to think about. So he's going to move in a different direction, I think, increasingly back to the Western Hemisphere. The problem for him is that he's still hostage to donors. And the donors aren't willing to leave. They aren't willing to abandon their positions in Europe and the Middle East and Northeast Asia and elsewhere. They're not terribly concerned about us as a people or the nation that they live in. They're concerned about other things. Most importantly, their financial power, their capital. And so they're telling President Trump, I'm sorry, this is what we want. You've got to go to war with Iran. You've got to stay in Ukraine. You've got to be prepared for a fight in Northeast Asia. And if you won't do this, then, you know, we're going to pull our support from you. And I don't think he can live without that support.
Well, that may be what they want, and they may be able to say that's what you need to do. And if he feels politically constrained because of the lack of support domestically on his domestic agenda, which he certainly is going to need heading into an election year in the House of Representatives especially. But what all of these folks may not count on, and even you're going out with a whimper situation for NATO, could completely be undone because of decades of foolish financial policies, and they may be coming back to roost. You've mentioned several times on this show, even over the past half year or so, with a little more frequency. Well, there's been a couple of statements of late in just the last few days by some really big names that are stridently sounding alarms, and I think that they're being ignored to our own peril. And I wonder if you can kind of comment on some of this. First of all, is Ken Griffin at the Davos meeting said, "Hey, folks, we could be in 1920s territory."
This is not a parallel to the 1920s in terms of the recklessness of the private capital markets. It's a story of the recklessness of government spending. Within the private sector, there's a huge question as to where AI will take us. And I was carefully taking notes and listening to what Larry has to say or to what Madame Lagarde has to say, because this is one of the big issues of our moment. Will AI create the productivity acceleration that is honestly just hoped for in Washington and in the halls of government around the world as a way to overcome the profligate spending that we're currently engaged in?
So what he went on to talk about there in some of those, that panel, they didn't come to the same conclusion. They said, no, we think that AI is going to be able to do this, so everything's going to be fine. But what he's saying was, and what I think is the really big alarm bell that was missed by a lot of people, it's not just that we're in 1920s territory, but it's why we're in 1920s territory. It's not that private equity is having a problem and they could overspend, but it's that the government spending of these different countries is overextended. And so the mechanisms that we've used, like in the 2003 financial crisis, to get out of that with quantitative easing, et cetera, you can't write your way out of it anymore because it's the banks themselves that are compromised. And so if AI doesn't provide to be the savior, as he said, then we are screwed. How do you see it?
Well, he's not being completely honest about private equity. Private equity has been benefiting from quantitative easing behind the scenes for months. Bessent has gone in and rescued private equity repeatedly over the last 6 months. It's not just the banks. It is the governments. It's all of them together, including his friends and the people sitting on that stage, especially somebody like Larry Fink. They're all in this. And yes, it is going to collapse. There's no question about it. And we're headed into that territory. But no one is going to admit that publicly. Look, back in June of 1929, Secretary Mellon, this was the Secretary of the Treasury, President Hoover, he gave a speech in June of 29, and he was sent to give the speech to quell rumors of impending disaster, problems in the marketplace that had to be addressed, and the Federal Reserve's mismanagement and so forth. So he gave a speech and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, prosperity is unbroken in this era." In other words, we in the United States are going to continue to enjoy the prosperity and good times that we've had to this point in perpetuity. And everybody gave him a standing ovation. Now, why do I know this? Because one of my great grandfathers was present for that speech. He lost $4 million in 1929. He trusted Mellon. Mellon was lying. And when FDR became president, he went after Mellon. He tried very, very hard to put Mellon in jail, and he richly deserved to go to jail. And I think that one of the things that keeps the printing press going is that all of the people in private equity, as well as in the banking system and government, they're all afraid that when the truth finally hits and things collapse, that they are going to be on the proverbial chopping block. And at some point in all of these countries in the West, there's going to be a tennis court moment. This is what happened during the French Revolution. Go back and look up tennis court moment, when the delegates finally said the king has lost his mind. Nothing's going to change. We're going to have to take control before everything is destroyed. And that's how you got the French Revolution. I think you're going to see something similar in Europe and here in the United States. but not until it really strikes, and it hasn't struck yet.
Well, and maybe we're getting closer to that too, because I couldn't help but thinking as you're talking there, the shivering parallels between what President Trump is saying on a regular basis about how, man, we are winning, so we're going to get tired of winning, and our economy is going great, and every speech he gives, just the one he gave 2 nights ago, yeah, same kind of situation. Man, we are doing great. Everything's coming. The prices are coming down. Inflation, all the indicators, everything's just saying everything's going great, even though when I go to the store, I don't quite see it that way. But well, so far, it hasn't collapsed.
It's not just the store. This morning, and it's too bad I don't have it in front of me. I didn't know you were going to go down this route. But I saw a graph this morning. It was put together by financial firms showing the dollar dropping in value. And it's now hit a low that we haven't seen since 2022. The dollar's in a lot of trouble. It's falling like a rock. Now, will it go away overnight? Will it completely collapse overnight? No. But we're on the same road that Japan is. And people here in the United States don't seem to be aware of it. And I think that's what Griffin was trying to say in a roundabout way, but he wasn't prepared to go as far as I have. There you go. That's pretty good. U.S. dollar in 2025. So look at the chart. It's very obvious. And here's President Trump telling us the dollar is strong. It's stronger than ever, and everything's going great. Okay. Thanks, President Trump. Appreciate your interest in our economy.
Economic security, yeah.
Yeah, but things aren't quite as you suggest they are. You know, it's always a good idea to be truthful, even if the news is bad. The truth is unassailable. It'll defend itself and try to identify with it. That's not popular right now because people are very upset, but they haven't gone crazy yet. In other words, we haven't yet reached lunatic proportions, which is what happened in France in 1789, 90, 91. People finally said, that's it. And they went over the cliff, so to say, into a total revolution. I would not exclude that right now in the countries of Western Europe and the United States.
Well, listen, Doug, you mentioned, I mean, Gary found that chart right there. That was also a comment by Peter Schiff, who was pretty adamant about it. I mean, you say no one's telling the truth. He's coming pretty close to in this clip right here.
The world is now pulling the rug out from under the U.S. The dollar is going to collapse. The dollar is going to be replaced by gold. Central banks are buying gold
up that
their currencies.
True.
They're getting rid of dollars. They're getting rid of treasuries. We are headed for a economic crisis, again, that will make the 2008 financial crisis look like a Sunday school picnic. The biggest difference between the crisis that we're about to have and the one we had back then is this one is all in America. It's not going to be exported to the rest of the world. It's not a global financial crisis. It's an American financial crisis.
Now, that was this morning, and gold was trading at $5,100 an ounce then. Subsequent to that, it went to $5,400. I think it dropped a little since I made this screenshot here. But that is an astronomical rise, which, of course, is because central banks are buying up the gold around the world because they are fearful that the dollar is losing. And to me, Doug, this could just spur a panic, and this could continue going this direction at the expense of the dollar.
Well, that's true, but keep in mind, and this is something just to check it, make sure that we've got it right here. Central banks in a number of states over the last 3 or 4 years have been buying gold, and everybody doesn't seem to understand it. I don't know why we don't understand it. I don't know why people refuse to bring it up. But central banks in Poland and Russia and India, any number of countries have been buying vast quantities
as well.
Yeah, exactly. Now we supposedly have more gold than anybody else, but we've never been able to audit the thing. And remember that Dr. Ron Paul predicted, this is 10, 15 years ago, that eventually gold would hit $6,000. And everybody sort of looked at him as though he had a large, hole in his head. Right now, gold and silver are going bizarre. Now, the only thing that he said that isn't true is that the dollar is no longer the reserve currency. That's not true. Gold is effectively the reserve currency now. That's what Nassim Taleb has been saying for God knows how long. and nobody's wanted to listen. And silver is important because silver is sits at the intersection of three critical categories that people don't normally understand. Monetary metal, that is, you know, basic currency, industrial commodity, and strategic mineral. You just think, every F-35 jet contains silver. Every satellite contains silver. Every missile guidance system contains silver. Solar alone will consume 20% of the annual silver production by 2027. The math doesn't work without new supply, and we're running out of supply.
Yeah, and so how do you get to that tipping moment? Because you can't keep going in these directions too long, because at some point, I mean, the dollar is going to continue to weaken, and it's going to, interest rates are going to go up, then prices are going to go up, and then you get where it actually affects Main Street America. How do you see that playing out?
Well, I think the unquestioning trust in dollar-denominated reserves is gone. In other words, people always looked at the dollar and said, oh, sure, there may be a problem here, there, or something, but the United States is the strongest economy. The United States is the strongest military. The United States is still the center of innovation and so forth. That's no longer widely believed. The American brand has been badly harmed over the last 30 years, specifically over the last 20. And I don't see any evidence that that's going to change. So I would argue that the dollar really died in February 2022, and what we're watching now is the funeral procession.
And by the way, the funeral procession is picking up some speed, because here in just the last few days, you've had Canada has inked a bunch of deals with BRICS member China. You've had the EU ink deals with BRICS member India. You have Keir Starmer, who's right now in China, inking more deals. People are starting to look in other areas besides the U.S. for economic stability. Once that starts happening, I mean, it does seem to be inevitable that at some point the absence of the trust in the dollar is going to be exposed, and I don't think we can recover from it, Doug. What do you think?
Well, you just uttered a couple of very important words. I mean, we were talking earlier about trust. People no longer trust us. We are erratic. Remember, we've talked repeatedly about the United States is now being treated in most of Asia as a sort of patient zero. We're the crazy man at the end of the hallway. Nobody knows what we're going to do next. And then you talked about stability. You know, stability is incredibly important. When you do business with China, the Chinese give you pricing stability. In other words, you don't have to worry that in a year or 2 years, the price is going to go through the roof. You don't have to worry about sanctions being imposed on you. In other words, you're doing business, period. And one of the pillars of successful business is price stability. So if you're in the supply chain, or if you're in production, whatever it turns out to be, this is vitally important. We're not providing that sort of thing. That's the problem. You've got to provide it, and we're not. So, you know, I think, where are we going? I just think, first, you know, every decision that Beijing makes on trade connects to their timeline for reunification. You know, rare earth leverage is a tool to discourage American intervention. They've got us in a hostage situation. In 2026, Beijing understands political cycles better than most Americans. They'll calibrate pressure to maximize domestic division. Expect selective tariffs on swing state industries. You know, the AI race is a resource race. If you don't have access to the rare earths, you can't make the chips. If you can't make the chips, you're out of business. Right now, we have no refinery for rare earths, so we can extract it, but we have to ship it to China. 90% of all the rare earths are refined by China. I mean, this is crazy, Dan. We are very dependent on the very people that we insist on treating as the enemy. And then, you know, this is a lot of self-inflicted stuff. You know, over four decades, we've demonized nuclear power. And at the same time, the Chinese built 50 new nuclear power stations. Mm. They've worked steadily. You know, a friend mentioned to me just the other day, he said, you know, we spend $1 trillion on, I think $1 trillion on defense. At We spend $20 on defense. That's fine. The Chinese spend $20 billion on rare earth refining, and they corner the market. That's you can't keep up with $20 billion versus $1 trillion. But we're using the military instrument repeatedly when it's the wrong instrument for the competition.
Right.
That's the biggest problem. We haven't figured out, hey, the world has changed. You know, we didn't pay any attention to who is at the other end of the supply chain, who is producing, who is manufacturing. You know, not just rare earths that are refined, but electronic components and the microchips that come out of Taiwan. There is so much, how do you put this? How do you explain the complete and utter failure to think beyond the end of the next quarter? And that's where we are. The Chinese have been carefully developing and producing a strategic approach over the last 30 years. It's now bearing fruit.
Yeah, and it looks, though, Doug, like we're about ready to start just cutting down the fruit trees that we've had. We want to cut them down as well. So if ever there was a time to start rolling back and realizing that the military is not the right instrument, President Trump seems inclined to use it yet again, this time potentially in Iran. And for some people that are close to the president, it's a pretty simple situation, as Mike Pompeo says here.
This is not that complicated. This regime has to go at this point. There's no deal. There's no agreement. President Obama tried that path. It led to continue their nuclear program. Joe Biden, President Biden, tried to do the same thing. This is not a regime that could be negotiated with. This is a regime that is going to have to be forced from power by the Iranian people, and the United States can provide support for that.
Now, I get, Doug, that there are forward-facing messages that are shielding what the real intent is behind. But surely we can't be this myopic that we don't realize all of the second and third order effects, things that are affected by an action like this. And you've been talking about on things that have with genuine regime stability and our governmental stability are at stake, and our people with our economic foundation, that this thing could be working against. Surely we don't want to put all that at risk by starting another war with Iran. Right.
Look, we're on a dangerous road that leads from failure to failure to failure, going all the way back to 1965. We came off the gold standard primarily because we were financially destroyed as a result of spending on the Vietnam War on one hand and the Great Society at home. LBJ wanted to do both when you could only do one at a time. That was the reason for going off the gold standard. So then you were in a position that you no longer had to go to the American people and say, well, we want to go intervene in country X or country Y, change its government, transform it into another gleaming example of liberal democracy, so we're going to raise your taxes. There's no reason to raise taxes. You hit the button and you create the money. So we have been creating wealth that isn't real for decades. All of this is going to come to an end. And that's really Peter Schiff's message. I think Griffin, if you listen to him carefully, was implying the same thing. Nobody is going to stand up and admit to this. Larry Fink is part of the cabal that is driving policy. He has to be taken very seriously right now in this White House, since he's one of the individuals that supported Donald Trump. And he's not alone. You could go down the list of billionaires. And these people want certain things. And right now, Donald Trump is expected to deliver on a promise that he made. And that is that he would eventually attack and destroy Iran. Now, what do you do when you're dealing with a nation the size of Western Europe that has over 90 million people in it? I think the latest number was 93 million. Well, you destroy it economically. We've done that. We've ruined the currency. They're still holding together, which is miraculous in many respects. But they're also being helped and supported now dramatically by China and Russia, not just with military matters and military equipment and technology, but in other ways. And increasingly, people in the region are saying, we don't want to see Iran destroyed. But what else can you do to Iran? You can't invade it and occupy it. That's beyond our ability. We don't have that many forces to do something like that. It would take millions and millions of troops for such an operation. We're not going to raise those. So what are we going to do? We're going to hurl explosives at it. We're not only going to try to kill the leadership, as we have in the past, but we're going to destroy the infrastructure. Whatever manufacturing base exists, we're going to kill it. Whatever infrastructure is there that supports the population, we're going to destroy it. If we can force deprivation on the population in terms of water and food, that's what we're going to do. Iran must be destroyed. That is Mr. Netanyahu's demand. And the billionaires that sponsored Donald Trump for the presidency are listening to Netanyahu. And as a result, Mr. Trump is listening to Mr. Netanyahu. That's where we're headed. So we're not trying to achieve some sophisticated goal that will lead to an end state where everybody lives with each other in the future. Far from it. This is a war of ruthless destruction of Iran. That's all it is. And that's what we're going to do. And at the end of it, we're going to regret it for all the reasons that you and others have already pointed out. It's not just the oil and natural gas that come out of there. It becomes, I guess, liquefied gas when it moves, but that comes out of the Persian Gulf. We know that China imports at least 30%+ of the oil that comes out of the Gulf and almost 90% of their own needs. This is a huge chunk. That's going to have an impact. There's no doubt about it. And I don't know that President Trump is unaware. I just think that President Trump is in a box. And his rhetoric has been so belligerent and so threatening, and his demands are consistent with Israeli talking points, which are unyielding and demand an uncompromising outcome. And I don't see much evidence that the Iranians are going to surrender. So he's saying what you're going to witness is 12 times worse than anything you've ever seen. I think that's where we're headed. And it's not going to be good for us. I don't think it's going to be good for the world.
And you know, I think this is, I think I perceive anyway that the president, or at least some of his advisors, his senior advisors, believe the rhetoric, which is we can do whatever we want. Look what happened in Venezuela. We did exactly what we wanted. Look what we did in Iraq, in Iran last year. Look what we did in Nigeria, et cetera. We can do whatever you want. No one's going to do anything. President Trump was asked about a week ago, 10 days ago, Iran says that they're going to retaliate if you strike this time. And he says, well, that's what they said the first time, and they didn't do it. And then now here, this is, I think this is from earlier today. This is the foreign minister, Araghchi, says our brave forces are prepared with their fingers on the trigger to immediately and powerfully respond to any aggression against our beloved country. And he goes on to say that, you know, we're willing to have a negotiated deal, but only if it's mutually beneficial. So basically saying that whatever you're offering is not even on the table because you're not offering anything mutually beneficial. Meanwhile, we have the Wall Street Journal out this morning that said, by the way, Iran has been battered, but they are still able to mount a deadly response. And you see they have 2,000 mid-range ballistic missiles of apparently very capable models that can penetrate air defenses, both in the U.S. and Iran, Israel. They have strategic stockpiles of short-range missiles capable of hitting U.S. forces there, anti-ship missiles, as well as cruise missiles. In other words, they have plenty of power that, if pushed, they can strike back. So if – now let's just look at it militarily for the moment. If President Trump, whether he's boxed in or not, whether he gives in to the pressure or not, does give the order here, and he thinks he's going to do something safe, but instead of playing it safe on the other side, Iran finally says, I've had enough, and they actually start firing and killing Americans and blowing up ships, bases, and stuff in the region – what does Trump have on his hand then?
I think he will alienate most of the world. We're already on a path of division. You're going to have increasingly this thing called BRICS on one side. I think it will eventually have as many as 100 members. People are going to migrate to it to get out from underneath our financial system so that they're not bullied by us. Increasingly, nobody wants the dollar. They're dumping dollars, and they don't want to do business in dollars. Now, that will not go away immediately, but the trend lines are unambiguous, and I don't think they're going to change. And then on the other side, you have us, probably the West Europeans, and potentially a few others. I don't know where they'll be, maybe in Latin America some. And that's the alternative system. It's effectively the old system that we dominate and continue to maintain. So the world will split into two financial halves. That has interesting implications for economic development and future productivity down the line. I can't even begin to imagine all those implications, but I think that's where we're headed. And I think what this does is simply hasten or accelerate that process of division, because Iran is more than the canary in the coal mine. The canary in the coal mine was the 1922 decision by the Russians to intervene in Ukraine. And most of the world recognized that they had to do that to protect themselves as well as the Russians on the ground in Ukraine. We're the ones that keep objecting to that, saying this was completely unprovoked. Nonsense. Yeah. It's just nobody buys that outside the United States, or almost nobody does. That's an Anglo-American or Israeli narrative. So you're going to get this split. And I think that the Iranian experience against us is going to really sour the rest of the world on us. And I think we'll see the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction as a result. I mean, why would you want to end up in a position like the Iranians, where you have no nuclear weapon and you risk the very high probability that the Israelis will use one against you? Because if the Iranians do not exercise any restraint, if they decide that's it, we have no incentive now to back down or to back off. This is a do or die proposition. What's to stop the Israelis from delivering a nuclear strike against the Iranians? And if that happens, what do we do? What do the Russians do? What do the Chinese do?
What do the Pakistanis do?
Or Pakistan too. And we now have this Pakistani Saudi Turkish alliance. It's very, very serious. I mean, the Turks, they're the outliers. But the Turks are very concerned about what happens to Iran. They may have their differences with the Shiites in Iran, but they don't want to see Iran destroyed. Their view is if you destroy Iran, that's going to have terrible, terrible blast effects on everybody else. Everybody in the region is going to be in the receipt of millions of refugees, and our own societies will be at risk. So the Turks are working with the Iranians. You know about the last time, I think we talked about the Kurdish intervention and how that was reported to the Iranians and so forth. This we're beyond just a regional conflict over a piece of ground or some resources. This is now an existential moment for Iran, and I think for everybody in the Middle East.
And let me ask you pointedly, I want to narrow down a little bit on the United States, because I have real worries about what President Trump may be faced with. So I think he is of the opinion right now that he can launch a few missiles and do so safely, and there won't be a response. But if it doesn't happen, if Iran does say one strike anywhere equals we're going all in on you, if that happens, what can President Trump do? Because if Iran starts hitting bases at Al Udeid in Qatar or in Bahrain, somebody's like, hit some of our ships, he can't just stop. He can't just back down, even though that would be the wise thing to do. But the minute that you have smoldering wreckages of Americans and body bags, you know, coming in Dover Air Force Base exchanges and all that kind of stuff, there'll be an outcry to go back and do more. But we can't do more. Well, I mean, we can't invade the place, as you said a second ago. I mean, we physically don't have the capacity, much less the political will. What then does that leave Trump? In the event that Americans get killed in a retaliation, what are his options next?
Based upon what I've seen from him and his administration to this point, if you look at the tariffs, he'll double down. He'll reinforce failure. Well, the last 300 or 400 missile strikes haven't done the job. I want another 500 missile strikes. If they don't do the job, then we'll have to have more missile strikes. The problem is, I think we have about 2 weeks' worth of missiles.
Yeah, that's what I was about to ask.
In every category. We don't have to go through those separate categories. And this goes back to something else that I've said repeatedly to people. They all look at me and say, no, you know what you're talking about. Remember, we're an aerospace and maritime power. Wherever we go, our presence there is temporary. It's not permanent. In other words, we don't live there. Our population doesn't live there. Now, what does that mean? That means that if you fight a war against a continental power, and that includes Iran or Russia or China or others that live on the Eurasian continent, they have the advantage in many respects of almost limitless depth strategically. In other words, not only in size, but in the numbers of things that they can produce and hurl at you. So I think we're at risk of running out of missiles and capabilities sooner than the Iranians will. Now, that doesn't mean the Iranians will walk away as major winners in this contest. I don't think there will be any winners in this contest, least of all us, because the consequences here at home economically will be profound. So then we come to your question, which is, we started this war, contrary to what anybody will tell the American public, and I'm sure Mr. Pompeo will be out there as his masters dictate that he go out and say that we were attacked by the evil Iranians, that Iran is the menace to the world, and we have to finish the job. The question is, will Americans buy that argument? I'm skeptical. I think right now Americans are very, very upset and discontented with the failure to make the progress here at home that President Trump wants to make. I mean, I'm somebody, and you know this, Dan, I support what the president wants to do domestically. I don't support, the lack of a strategy. I'm disappointed that it hasn't been well-organized and well-executed. But that's part of the problem with doing things here at home, is you're also doing things overseas. It's back to the LBJ problem. President Trump early on needed to make a choice. Where do I want to go? And what we have to say is, well, President Trump, the people that voted for you did not vote for a war with Iran. They didn't vote for a war in Ukraine. They didn't vote for a war with Venezuela. That's not their interest. They're voting for the United States. They want the rule of law and order here in the United States desperately. They do want these millions of aliens that are in the country identified and packed up and moved out of the country. They really do. I mean, you could look at all the polling. They favored this for a long time. How you do it's another matter. I don't think we've thought that through very much. But you can't do those things at home. You want to repatriate manufacturing. So you launch a tariff war, you alienate everyone everywhere, and then you act as though we have every right to do this because everybody owes us something. The world doesn't feel that way. Telling them that they all owe us something. I listened to President Trump say, well, we won the Second World War. Yeah, we were on the winning side, Mr. President. We didn't win it alone. And we were very anxious to get it over with as quickly as possible and get back to business, which is what we did ultimately. And we ought to remember that. But telling all these people your gratitude is insufficient for all that we've done for you, that's a waste of time. Yeah. That may appeal to some people in the MAGA base, but it's just nonsense. Forget it. How do you get him to say, I want to rethink what I'm doing now. Maybe this isn't such a good idea. But he's got all of these billionaires that have put him in the driver's seat. How does he turn to them and say, thanks, but can't do it? If he does that, how long will he last? What will they do? And we know what they will do. They will just turn their money entirely in the other direction. Because what happened under Biden, the same billionaires that were driving the Biden administration to war in Ukraine and backing Netanyahu in the Middle East are the same people that put Trump into office. So they'll just turn their efforts in support of somebody else in the effort to punish Trump. The problem is our country's going to be in a lot of trouble by then. And I'm not sure that they can expect to have the same level of influence in the future that they've had to this point, especially since they're pushing us over the cliff.
Right. Yeah. And if we have a 1789 moment like you were talking about before, which is my great fear, nobody's going to be safe. Not even those guys. Their money won't help them out at that time. And God help us all if we get to that point. We just have to hope that the pain can be slow enough in coming in so it's not a collapse moment, but a slow descent moment to where when the pain gets enough that maybe we can start making some changes before the worst of the outcomes occur. Because if we don't, I fear that they could get really ugly indeed, even at home.
Well, of course. We've done everything we possibly could since 2008 to postpone a reckoning. Remember, if you go back to 2007, 2008, when President Obama came in, suddenly everyone that was in trouble financially all over the United States and in New York City and Washington and so forth, they were all compensated with a dollar for every dollar lost. And I remember Sheila Bair, who said, well, why not pay them 10 cents on the dollar? These people should be punished for their mismanagement, their recklessness, even criminal behavior. And there was, oh, no. And Paulson and his friends at Goldman Sachs bailed everybody out. Okay, so now we've bailed everybody out. And this time around, there won't be any bailouts. That's pretty clear.
It is. And that's why the best thing President Trump could do is whatever pain that he could genuinely face and legitimately face from these financial backers if he turns and doesn't do what they want. I don't minimize that because that's real. But that is nothing compared to what's going to happen if he listens to them, continues on down these paths, especially not into the Russia-Ukraine war and starting an Iranian war. It could have consequences that nobody could control with or without the backing. And that's the thing I worry about.
Yeah, well, it's sort of like World War One. You know, did the Tsar have to mobilize and declare war on Germany and Austria-Hungary? No, he didn't. And there were many people that said, forget it. We don't want to be part of this destructive war. Our economy is actually beginning to grow finally. We're producing, you know, steel at number 4 or 5 in the world. Living standards can come up. The population is happy. You know, let's not go to war. But he did. You know, it's very sad and tragic for that matter. There's the Austrian emperor, Franz Josef. The Hungarians delayed their support for war for 2 weeks, and they had to practically bribe the Hungarians to join the war effort. Disaster. That was a war that should not have been fought. It wasn't necessary, but everybody was dragged into it. And the British, they sat out there and had never been part of this continental mess, certainly really not since Napoleon, and they decided to jump on board, even though they all admitted, well, there's no real interest at stake here. And no German-speaking soldier had fired at an English-speaking soldier at that point in over 200 years. But people do stupid things. And that's why I say I'm worried that if this progresses and we don't get the results that President Trump is being told they can get, we don't know what he's being told.
Yeah.
That's a big problem.
It is.
But if the results don't show up the way he expects them to, he's predisposed to double down. And we've seen that especially with air power over the last 80 years. Well, if the 500,000 tons didn't work, 1 million tons may work. And you keep it up and you declare victory. This time around, I don't know.
Yeah, it's a big unknown. And I guess we're all going to find out together because it's hard for me to imagine. I hope that it does, but it's hard for me to imagine that he won't launch a strike here. I think he's boxed himself in, but we'll just have to wait and see, and then call the shots when they, or the balls and strikes when they happen.
Yep. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks very much for coming on today, Doug, and providing this clarity on this. We don't like some of these answers, but this is stuff that we all need to know. So we need to understand what we're facing. We are unintimidated and uncompromised to bring you that truth. And we're going to have it just like we did on this show here. We ask you to share this, by the way. Share with others too. Some people only like to get their stuff with podcast. Send them the podcast. We're on podcast there. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podcast Addict, Daniel Davis Deep Dive. You'll find us there. Send this out to them. The written word on Substack, we have that here. And obviously this one too. Like and subscribe if you haven't. That helps more than you think. Get the word out, folks. Don't let this catch people by surprise. Look forward to seeing you on the next episode of Daniel Davis Deep Dive.